in week four of our look at Megillat Esther. First week we just introduced to the book, then we launched into the book itself, we talked about its themes, and we've now been in Perek Aleph in chapter one. We started out by giving different approaches to the party of Ahasuerus and what that was about, what Ahasuerus was trying to accomplish with the party, or more, how Megillat Esther looks at the party. So is it a demonstration of Ahasuerus's obsession with power and status? Is it setting up the book as a book of exile, so that it's about the defeat of the Jews and the Jewish exile, 70 years having elapsed and so on? Or is it about God manipulating things? This is God's feast and God's story. God is putting everything into place so that it will play out across the book. Those three different views. Plus we had that other Persian note about them making big decisions at feasts, and the big decision at that point potentially for Xerxes being the decision about going to war with Greece. So that was all from our original point on week one, on chapter one, and then we moved in to talk about Vashti last week, and I wanted to pick up from there. I did ask in the email, as I asked last week, for everyone to have a Tanakh with them. This is my Tanakh that I was given by the Women's League of Hebrew Academy of Long Beach back when I graduated there, and it's still useful. See that? You can hold on to things.
It's a great place.
Yes, it is, Alan. Yes, indeed. Alan's my former babysitter from quite a few years ago. Okay. Haven't announced that at a shiur in a few years. I'm getting out of habit. So, in any case, the discussion that we started about Vashti was this very odd midrash that says that Vashti was actually the daughter of a Babylonian king, and that Ahasuerus was her father's servant, and that by marrying her, he became king, but only by virtue of marrying her does he become king. And this is found in the Gemara in Megillah, we brought it last week. It's also found in the Medrash in Esther Rabbah, which lists four women who took the reins of the kingdom for themselves. Izebel, Jezebel, Atalia, who we'll come back to talk about a little bit later, Shemiramit, who is a whole other story, and Vashti. So the question that we asked at the end last time was, where in the world did the sages come up with this idea? How do you come up with this? This is not something that has a precedent in secular literature, that there are stories that go around about Xerxes having a wife who was actually the daughter of a Babylonian king. There is a lot of material about Xerxes' wife. Her name, interestingly, was Amestris. We talked about that in week one, and the question of whether Amestris is Esther is an interesting one. But where did they get this from? So what we suggested last time was that they may be trying to answer two questions. Question number one, why in the world does Ahasuerus want to put her on display for his party? Even if I don't take the Midrash's read of the sentence in which Ahasuerus tries to put her on display, in other words, the Midrash says that he wants her to be exposed entirely for everybody to see her, but even without that, he says that she should be brought, looking at the verses in chapter 1, it is chapter 1, sentence 11, to bring Queen Vashti before the king in the royal crown, b'cheser malchus, laharos ha'amim v'hasrim es yofya, to display to the nations and to the nobles her beauty. Like, why in the world, I'm just going to mute everybody by default, you can unmute to ask questions, of course, but why in the world is Ahasuerus interested in putting her on display? Usually, certainly in Tanakh, but in general, we assume that kings are very possessive and that their approach to their queens is that, you know, the queen belongs to me. So why in the world would Ahasuerus want to do this? That was one question we felt we were trying to answer. And then the other one is her imperious response. No way, I'm not going. Like, normally, the king is the one who holds the power, and when the king demands something, the queen does it. How does she think she's going to get away with refusing the king's command? And we're going to pick up from that point. I rushed through it at the end last time, but now we're really going to do this properly. So we'll pick up from there. And so I will note now also, thanks to Dana and Ilan Rubinstein for dedicating the series. And also this particular session is associated with the following contributions from the Day of Giving we held in July from Eric and Judy Marmer, Frank and Eva Mayer, and Stephen Malach. So thank you. What we started to suggest at the end last time is that you have to realize there are different kinds of midrashim. There are midrashim that are not really midrashim, that are just trying to teach me a message. And when I say that they're not really midrashim, what I mean is midrash by definition is analysis of text. That's where it comes from. You're extrapolating something from textual anomalies. If there isn't a textual anomaly, if it's just here's a nice lesson, that's not a midrash. But then among midrashim, you have two kinds. You have some that are tradition. You have something odd in the text. Well, the answer is, I have a tradition from way back when that this is what was going on in that story. And in other cases, it's a deductive midrash, in which the sages themselves are looking at the problem in the text and saying, I think there's a way to explain that and to show how that actually explains details within the story. It's deductive midrash. And that's what I think you're seeing here. They're looking at Vashti's imperiousness. They're looking at her fearlessness regarding her husband. And what they see is that this fits a model found elsewhere in Tanakh. The daughter of royalty who holds that above her husband. That's really the key here. The daughter of royalty who holds that status above her husband. And we go back to the list of women who took the reins of a kingdom for themselves. And one of those was Izebel. Jezebel, she's a perfect example of it, but now we're going to see others. So this is really a biblical archetype. And if you take a look on your sheets now, at source number one, I gave you references to certain psukim, certain verses that I'd like us to see. The first one is Malachim Aleph, Kings 1, chapter 21, sentence 25. And because everybody is using different editions of Tanakh, I'm not going to announce page numbers. It ain't going to help.
You can announce the page number you're using because I'm using the same book.
Are you? You've got...
Sorry. Can you say what the...
Yours is Hebrew English, isn't it, Joyce?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this isn't. This is before they had English.
Okay.
Sorry, what did somebody say? Somebody asked...
Could you just announce again what we're
looking at? So I'm going to announce again that it's source number one on the sheet. We're just going through those verses. That's why I put them there, because otherwise it becomes chaos. So chapter 21, sentence 25, is from the story of King Ahav. And what we're told here is that, if you follow the text, Rak lo hayach Ahav asher hitmaker la'asot hara be'inei Hashem. There was no one like Ahav, who literally sold himself, or was sold himself, to do evil in God's eyes. Asher heisata oto Izebel ishto. But how did he end up doing it? Because his wife Izebel, Jezebel, was the one who got him to do it. She was the one who persuaded him to do it. She is the dominant one in this relationship. Something that really comes through if you look at the second verse that I referenced in source number one from Malachim Bet, Kings 2, chapter 10, sentence 13. And the key is the end of that sentence. The sentence is not about Izebel, it's not about Jezebel. However, it's about her kids, who are identified in the end of that sentence. Again, it's chapter 10, sentence 13. In Kings 2. They are identified as Bnei HaGivira, the sons of the Givira. What does Givira mean?
Beautiful.
I would think it's an important woman, just like a gever is an important man.
It's the powerful woman, right? It's the female of Gibor. The make no mistake, the power on this throne is actually Izebel. It is Jezebel. So she is a paradigm for this, the queen who is actually the real one in charge. Another example of that is Atalia, who we mentioned briefly earlier. And here I ask you to turn to Malachim Bet, Kings 2, chapter 11. Oh, is her story a difficult story? Those are at the Wednesday morning classes. We discussed her some time back, a couple of years ago. This is the story of Atalia. And right here, in one sentence, you get her story. Atalia is the mother of the king. The king is dead. So take a look at sentence one there, chapter 11. Va'atalia aim Achaziahu ra'ata kimet bina. Atalia, mother of Achaziah, sees her son has died. Va'takam va'te'abed eis kol zera ha'mamlacha. And so she killed out everybody else in the royal family. She takes the throne herself. She does not succeed. There's one survivor, and that's how she's thwarted in the end. But that's the another example of the woman who will hold on to the monarchy no matter what. We could add others to this list, though, not in terms of being very bloody people, but in terms of women who were themselves of royalty, and they held that power. I should note, I didn't mention it regarding Izebel, regarding Jezebel. It's not just that she's married to Ahab and controls what he does. It's also that she is the daughter of a non-Jewish king, right? Raises all sorts of questions. But she herself is the daughter of a non-Jewish king. She was independently royal. I should have mentioned that as well. And no coincidence, her daughter is Atalia. Like, you start to get a picture of where the family line is. But let's go earlier in our history. As I put in source number one, Shmuel Bet, Samuel 2, chapter 6, sentence 20. This is always an interesting story. David brings the Aron. David brings the ark, containing the tablets. Oops, I just flipped to the wrong book. Let's try that again. And he dances at the head of the parade. Well, his wife is also independently royal. His wife is Michal, daughter of Shaul, previous king. So look at her reaction to David. That's a fearless reaction for you. Vayashav David levareches beiso. David comes back to give gifts to his household. Vateitzei Michal bat Shaul likrat David. And Michal, emphasis, daughter of Shaul, comes out to greet David. And what does she have to say? Vatomer, she says, Manichbad hayom melech Yisrael. Oh, how honored today is the king of Israel. Asher nigla hayom le'enei amhot avadav ki galot niglot achad harikim. He's revealed today before the maids of his servants, like some empty person. You know, to which, of course, you know, David gives it back and says, you know, God chose me over your father. So, you know, take that. But Michal is not afraid to speak up to David, and she is daughter of the previous king. And then the other one is Malachim Aleph. We go back to Kings 1, chapter 7, sentences 1 to 8. And you read about the palace that Shlomo made in chapter 7. I'm not going to read all of that out loud. It's a very nice palace, very ornate, very elaborate. And we find out in the course of this passage, and I'm just going to pick it out here, sentence 8, the last sentence in the passage, we're told as well, Uvayit yaseh levat paro asher lakach Shlomo ka'ulam hazeh. She gets a palace like that also. The daughter of Paro also gets a cool palace just like his own. These are queens who themselves descend from royalty, and because of that, they hold special power. So that's the model. And I think what's going on is that the sages in this midrash look at that and say, well, Vashti fits. That would explain how she can defy Achashverosh, and it will explain a lot more. And this is what I referenced for you here on the sheet. I did not want to spend a lot of time going through text, because I feel like as important as it is that we're text-based, if it just becomes me showing you verses in Midrashim, then it's going to be a little overwhelming. So take a look at source number 2 on your sheet, where I wrote, well, that explains a lot. Because it does explain a lot. First of all, in sentences 9 to 12, the story of the party, the text keeps emphasizing, Vashti Hamalka, Hamalka Vashti. This is Queen Vashti. We keep emphasizing that. Why? Because it's principal to the story. Is her status independently as queen. The Malbim takes up that point. Also, the location of her party. Look back at sentence 9 and tell me, where's her party?
It was inside.
Not just inside, where is it?
Is it in her own palace?
Nope. Beit HaMalchut Asher LaMelech Achashverosh. She's holding it in Achashverosh's party. His party's outside. Her party is in the palace. That's really striking. Midrashim do other things with this. We want to come back later today in this, to talk more about this business. But she's got it in his royal palace. That's interesting. Not to mention the description in sentence 11 about how she is to be displayed. It's with Keter Malchut, with this crown. Well, that's not just any crown. That's the crown that she brought into the relationship. So her having a royal background explains certain things. But more than that, it also explains things about him. We go back to the opening sentence of the Megillah, which described Achashverosh with an odd term. It said, Vayhi bimei Achashverosh. It was in the days of Achashverosh. Who Achashverosh? He was Achashverosh. We talked about that already last time. Hamolech, who reigned, Mehodu v'ad Kush, and so on. So the Midrash picks up on that and says, that's an odd term to use. That's an odd verb to use. He is Achashverosh, who reigned. We know he reigned. That's the whole point. That's why we call him king. So what does it mean, he reigned? It's being presented, says the Midrash, it's a Gemara in Megillah, Daf Yud Aleph, as a verb. And what we're suggesting here is not, he reigned, that's not what it means. It means he took the throne. This was Achashverosh, who took the throne. That's the way to read that. And this also explains a lot. If Achashverosh, oh, sorry, let me just clarify. What I'm saying is, if he wasn't originally royal, that explains why he had to take the throne. He didn't have it. And that also explains some things outside of the text. His predecessor, King Cyrus, sent the Jews back to build the Beit HaMikdash, to build the temple. Darius empowers us to build the temple. There's a whole back and forth in the time of Darius. However, Achashverosh doesn't like Jews. Right? How do I know Achashverosh doesn't like Jews?
Party.
Why the party? What does the party tell me?
Well, if we say that the party was to celebrate the fact that the 70 years passed and that
yes.
they're still...
True, but how else can you tell it from the text itself? How do you know
happy? He was so happy when Haman...
How happy was he when Haman did this? You're right. How happy was he?
See, I think that he does not have an opinion at all.
Right, Ruchama, rak shnia. Betchila onim ala sheila, achar kach mipakpekim ala tshuva. Ala batchila onim ala sheila. How do you know that Achashverosh doesn't like Jews? Take a look at source at chapter 3, sentence 9. What does Haman offer Achashverosh to get rid of the Jews?
He offers him money, a lot of money.
Offers him what it looks like a decent sum of money. I would think so. And what does Ahasuerus say back to him?
I don't want it.
I don't want the money. You can keep the money. If he has no opinion about Jews, why does he say you can keep the money? I'll fund this myself.
It's in the building. There is some kind of noise there.
Okay. Yeah. I'll mute you until that's done. The Ahasuerus, we'll come back to you, don't worry. But Ahasuerus is not a fan of the Jews. You also know it because in the end of the story, when he knows Esther is Jewish, he's still not willing to save the Jews. There's more to be said about that. There's more to be said about Ahasuerus's non-royal background, but I'm saving some of it for when Haman gets elevated. This will fit very well in terms of Haman's narrative as well. Also, we understand now that her royal background explains a lot about her and about the text. His royal background explains a lot about him. He breaks from what Cyrus and Darius did for the Jews to be anti. The answer is he's not part of the royal line. But also, the power imbalance explains certain things. Because now let's go back to Ahasuerus having her brought to the party. In chapter 1, sentence 10. Tell me, how can you tell from the text that Ahasuerus is not entirely confident in what he's doing? How do I know that?
He asks for advice.
Where does he ask? In sentence 10, it's 10 to 12?
Oh, you're asking just 10, sorry.
Yeah, when he invites her to the party, how do you know that he's not so sure of himself?
He asks for so many guards. He said it's not just one person or a message.
Okay, fair. What else? Bruria, yes, you're muted.
I think he had to drink first.
Yeah.
Oh, he had lots of drink first. It only happens when he's drunk.
That's what I was going to say. I was going to say he needed to be drunk and
right.
to give him confidence to do this.
Okay.
Well, he needed 7 chamberlains.
Right. The chamberlains are mentioned. This is true. What else? Did he actually demand that she show up?
He didn't ask her directly.
Joyce hits it. He didn't say, Vashti, would you come to my party? He doesn't have the guts for that. He says to the agents, you guys, bring Vashti. And they look at him like, us? why make us do the dirty work? You know, you can imagine the subtext going back and forth, because I don't want to do it. You do it. He doesn't even make the request. And you notice, Malba makes this point, look at her refusal when she doesn't show up. Take a look at sentence 12. It says that Vashti refuses to show up bidvar hamelach asher biyad hasarisim, at the word of the king via these agents. She's like, who are you? Why are they these people? This is beneath her. Not only that, the power imbalance explains his extreme reaction when she won't come out. Right? And this is something I can never get enough of. Take a look at sentence 13. What is Ahasuerus' reaction when she won't show up? What does he do? This is awesome.
He needs to confer?
He needs to confer, and not just confer. Confer with royal counselors. Right? Isn't that great? I mean, the king has an issue, some kind of a disagreement with his wife, and he's going to summon a royal political council. How does that make any sense? So you could just say it's a sign of his insecurity. But I think it's a sign of the political imbalance between them. It's the power imbalance. He needs to go to them and get their support in order to be able to do anything about this. And it will also explain why he marries Esther. We're going to come back to this. But marrying Esther doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You take a woman whose background you don't even know, right? Kings are supposed to marry politically. He's had enough of marrying politically. He did that already. It didn't work out. Now he's going to go to the opposite extreme. He marries a woman who nobody knows where she came from. Because he's had enough of people who have power. So this model that we come up with, built on Isabel, built on Atalia, built on Michal, built on Bat Paro, explains a lot about the dynamic in this story. And I think that it answers one more question. And someone sort of inclined in this direction a little bit before, talking about the wine. He did this on day 7 of his Feast of the Commoners. Right? He had the 6-month feast for all the nobles. And then he has a 7-day feast for the commoners. Isn't that bizarre that he does it on day 7 of the Feast of the Commoners? Why is he doing this, first of all, for the common people? Why isn't he doing this for the royalty? Well, let's ask the question first. Before we get to that, I brought you Malbim on the sheet. Take a look at source number 3. I love reading Malbim. He says, Ayei sichlut gadol mizeh. Where is there greater foolishness than this? Shemoshel adir kazei etzavela v'eshet cheiko. That a mighty ruler like this commands them to bring his intimate bride, lahar otah lifnei hamon goyim v'hamon le'umim ki yifat mar'ehi, to show everybody, hey, look how pretty my queen is. Right? Like I said before, that's the opposite of the way kings in Tanakh conduct themselves. And especially if you go with the Midrash that he wanted to show up without clothing on, what in the world is he doing? And it's even more shocking. He's having his agents bring her against her will. He doesn't invite her. Like you would bring a degraded person out. To the point where she would choose to die rather than be humiliated in this way. So first of all, the whole thing doesn't make sense. But especially, you're doing this for the common people, and you're doing it on the last day of the party. Day 7. Why are you doing this on day 7? Why are you doing this on day 7? Why didn't you do this on day 3?
Because it says when the king was merry with wine.
Right. So one possibility is, as someone suggested earlier, that he needs to be good and drunk, right? And that's when this is going to happen. That's possible. But I wonder if it isn't some sort of plan. This is the apex of his party. If the goal of his party is to establish himself as king over everybody, then the apex of it is when he humiliates Vashti. I think that what you're really seeing in this story is so consistent with what the Midrash is suggesting about her heritage. Not that these questions are all the questions that lead to it. I think you need the paradigm in Tanakh in order to come up with that idea. But I think once you have that, everything else, all the dominoes just fall, right? Or in Hebrew, nafal ha'asimon. All of it now makes sense, for those who remember when asimonim fell. But nonetheless, I do want to note, I was talking to my son about this, and he asked me a question. So, if this is true, that Vashti is, the true royal in this relationship, why does the Megillah omit that? Isn't that a salient piece of information in order to understand the story? After all, it opened up so many different doors for us. Once we understood that, so many things in this story made sense. So why doesn't the Megillah say so?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I think he was asking a good question. So my answer is, because you have to remember who's still king at the end of chapter 10. Right? Ahasuerus is still the king at the end of this story. And if you are going to write this story in the Persian Empire, you're not going to say, by the way, Ahasuerus wasn't really king. Vashti was the power behind the throne, and he was the stable boy who married her. It's just politically a bad idea. Probably lands you in the same order that Vashti landed in. That would be my guess. That's consistent with what you're going to see when we get to chapter 9. And the way they write things up in the scroll about how Ahasuerus, when the scroll came to him, got rid of it and all of that, it's all of a picture. Yeah, we're not going to write things that are going to that are going to get us in trouble with the throne. Clear? Yes, Brona.
Rabbi, Vashti wasn't part of the harem, was she? Because I'm thinking, she made a feast for the women in the royal house. I mean, was that the harem?
So I think not. It sounds like these are guests from elsewhere. I can't prove that. But it's generally understood that these are women from the kingdom, so much so there's even a midrash that suggests this was actually a strategy that she hatched, having this party with Ahasuerus, that he would have all the men with him, and she would have the wives as hostages. In the event that there was a coup of any kind, she's holding the women hostage, which is a very interesting read. Not one that you hear often. But in general, it's assumed that these are not the women in the harem. Yeah. Ruchama, you were going to ask?
No, before I was it looked like, as I said before, he looks like a very stupid person, and he does not have his own opinion. And everything he's looking for, he asks somebody else. And he's it looks to me that he was drunk when he asked her to come. He was not in his, nothing makes sense, whatever he's doing, to me.
Okay. Okay. One other note, while we're here, and I just put I put a note about it in source number 4, Vashti, Esther, and Salome. So Salome is not one of ours. You will find her in the Christian Bible. But there are very odd and interesting parallels between her story and elements of Vashti and Esther. The idea of dancing in front of the king is an obvious one. The king offering her up to half of his empire is another one. So I've seen writers who have suggested that what you see here in Esther, and there have been a commentary, influences the early Christian writers. Proponents of early Christian writers may argue the opposite, but they have a harder row to hoe on that one. In any case, I just put it there for people who want to investigate that further. There's a whole internet in front of you. But let's get to Vashti's refusal now. Her statement of, I am not coming out to that party. There are, various midrashim, which I'm sure many of you learned at some point over the years. Right? Anyone want to offer one of them?
I read something that she was actually the most feminist in the Bible.
Okay. I'll go with Devorah, but okay.
Yes. It was in this book. It's a men's world. And here you have a woman that was strong enough to go away as she wants, not as he wants.
And got herself killed, but yes.
And I don't know if this has anything to do with anything, but there's a midrash that says Vashti had a tail.
So that's one of them. We've got a midrash that says not that she had a tail, but that she gained a tail in this story. That's one midrash, correct? Janine, you were going to say?
In her arms, she grew it.
Okay.
She grew it, not that she had.
Yes.
In her arms.
And horns? Maybe.
Yeah, both.
I mean, I'm talking about the Midrash as it exists in the Gemara, and it doesn't have horns. Jews have horns. Vashti doesn't have horns.
That she took the Jewish girls to work on Shabbos.
She took the Jewish girls to work on Shabbos, but why would that explain why she refuses to go to the party? I'm talking about Midrashim that explain why she refuses to go to the party.
Oh, that she had pimples. She had all those disgusting pimples.
Pimples. That's a sanitized way that they tell the story when you're in grade school. That's the,
right.
Yes, as we'll see. Okay,
exactly.
So there are actually two schools of thought. One school of thought is that she is villain, and the other school of thought is that she is victim. First of all, the idea that she is a villain. That's the view that you see dominantly in the Gemara. The Gemara in Megillah portrays Vashti as immoral. And the only reason she refuses to go to the party is because of what God does to her. Because God doesn't want her going to the party. So take a look at source number 5. The Gemara in Megillah. We pointed out already how strange it is that she's doing this party in the palace. So the Gemara asks the question and comes up with an answer that's different from the one we suggested. Beit HaMalchut. Right? In the royal palace. I'm just going to mute because I'm getting noise in the background. The Beit HaMalchut in the royal palace. Beit HaNashim Mibayilei. It should be in the house of the women, in the harem, in fact, as Brona suggested. So Amar Rava, Rava answers, Shnehen Lidvar Avera Nitkavnu. Both of them intended immorality, meaning her goal is actually to have the women near the men, and that way things could happen between them. That's the way that the Gemara reads this this act, and then follows up with what you see in source number 6, which portrays her as wicked to Jewish women specifically. There's a lot to be said about this midrash. We're not going through in depth. I just want to show this to you. In source number 6, Bayom Hashivi'i Ketov Lev HaMelech Bayayin. On day 7, when the king's heart was good with wine, so the Gemara asks somewhat sarcastically, Atu Ad Hashta Lo Tav Libei B'chamra? What, it took you 6 months and 7 days? Now his heart is good with wine? As Vashti said to him in a midrash that we read last week, he was drunk long ago. He can't hold his wine at all. So Amar Rava, Yom Hashvi'i Shabbat Haya. Rava says, no. Bayom Hashvi'i doesn't mean the 7th day of the party. Bayom Hashvi'i means it's Shabbos, is the way that he reads it. And what do you mean? Shebemidash Adam Modeid Bah Modedin Lo. The way you act towards others, that's what happens to you. What do you mean? And the Gemara goes on to explain. In the interest of time, I'm going to do my translation, but you can see the original there as well. This teaches that wicked Vashti brought Jewish girls, removed their clothes, and made them work on Shabbat. So it says, after these things, after this whole story, the beginning of chapter 2, when Ahasuerus calms down, he remembers Vashti and what she did and what was decreed upon her. And the Gemara says, Kishem she'asta, kach nigzar aleha. As was done to her, so was decreed upon her. Pausing here for a moment. Clearly the goal of this Gemara is to portray Vashti as wicked. That's, you know, fairly straightforward. However, what did they draw from that sentence of after these things when Ahasuerus calmed down, he remembered, how did that indicate that she was being punished for something? What is that? What are they picking up on in the text? I think they're picking up on the end. Asher nigzar aleha. Ahasuerus remembers that which was decreed upon her. You know what this is like? When a politician does something wrong and offends people, and then says, I'm sorry if you were offended. No. I'm sorry for offending you. If you were offended means it came from somewhere else. That's what happens here. He remembered what she did and what was decreed. What do you mean what was decreed? You decreed it. Asher gazar aleha, what he decreed upon her. The Medrash has such a fine ear, and it says, Nigzar, it was decreed in heaven for her that this should happen. That's what the Gemara is picking up on. It's detective work when you learn Medrash. But the other piece of this is the rest of the Gemara here, where the Gemara says, why does she refuse to come out to the party? Michti pritzta havoi, she's immoral. Like you just said, both of them wanted to have immorality. You said that in source number 5. So why doesn't she go to the party? This should have been exactly what she wanted. Why isn't she coming to the party? So Rabbi Yossi gives an answer. Rabbi Yossi Bar Chanina gives an answer. She developed tzara'at, or as Jeanette said, pimples. The tzara'at, you have to know, tzara'at does not necessarily mean tzara'at that's found in the Chumash. Tzara'at is often used in the Gemara as some kind of skin ailment that isn't necessarily the spiritual one that's found in the Torah, in Tazria Mitzorah. But the point is something, she breaks out in some kind of a rash, or in a Braita they taught, Gavriel came and gave her a tail. There's the tail of the tail. Why Malach Gavriel? Because Gavriel, if you learn Sefer Daniel, you know, is the angel who protects the Jews. He's the Gibor. He's the one who will act on our behalf. So in order to get her not to come out to the party, she gets this injury to her vanity. But in this whole set of Midrashim that you're seeing in the Gemara, Vashti is immoral, Vashti is evil, and the only reason she's not coming to the party is because of the humiliation of her skin condition or her tail. Medrash and Esther Rabbah, on the other hand, gives you the idea that no, she's a victim. Flip the page, source number 7, please. This has a message that she sends to Ahasuerus to try to get him to back down. And it's in 3 parts. And she's trying to get him to take the point and he's not getting it. So take a look. And just, again, for time reasons, we'll go with my English translation. And this way also I don't have to worry about going back and forth between Ashkenaz and Sephard the way I do. I can just read my English. She sent and told him that which would touch his heart. She tries to appeal to him. She said, if they see that I'm attractive, they're going to want to use me and they'll kill you. And if they see that I'm ugly, you'll be disgraced through me. It's a no-win, Ahasuerus. Why do you want to do this? She hinted, he didn't take the hint. She stung him, and he wasn't stung. So she tries again. She sent and told him, you were my father's head of the stables. You would bring unclothed zonot for yourself. Now you've become king and you have not left your corruption. You're still the guy who works in the stables. She hinted, he didn't take the hint. She stung him and he wasn't stung. She sent and said, even my father's defendants were not judged unclothed. It's talking about the story in Daniel, in which Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are thrown into the furnace for refusing to bow to the statue. And in that story, the text goes out of its way to emphasize that they're grabbed while they're still in their royal uniforms. So the commentators on that story in Daniel give different explanations for why that was. But the Gemara here is saying is they're not stripped of their dignity. So she doesn't want to go. And it's not about a tail, and it's not about Sara'at. It's about her dignity. She's being victimized here. That fits with the idea that she refuses because the Sarisim are the ones who come to her. So take a look at source number 8. Professor Tamar Kadari from Bar Ilan, she says the following in an article. I gave you the link so you can click on it and see the full article. The article is Vashti Midrashin Agadah. It's an interesting read. She says, this collection of Midrashim presents Vashti in a very negative light. She's talking about the ones in the Gemara. The adverse attitude of the rabbis in Babylonia to Vashti might possibly have resulted from the fact that Vashti was Babylonian. And for the rabbis, she represented the local Babylonian women who were, of course, promiscuous and Jew-haters. Emphasizing their negative traits probably aided in erecting barriers between the Jews living in Babylonia and the local Gentile women. In other words, what Dr. Kadari is suggesting is that the Gemara gives you a different approach from Esther Rabbah, because Esther Rabbah is written in Israel. Whereas Talmud Bavli is Babylonian, she has already been linked to the Babylonian Empire. So if I have to explain her actions, I'm going to look for a harsh and negative explanation. Sort of reminds me a little bit of what happens in Shoftim, in which you have this great contrast between the women of the Jewish people and the women of the land throughout Sefer Shoftim. And it's, seems to be in part presented as a polemic against marrying Canaanite women. So if you think of the women in Shoftim, we don't have time to go through this right now properly, but you think of Sisera's mother as one example. You think of the Plishti women who Shimshon gets involved with, especially Delilah. Yeah, you contrast that with Hatzlaponit, the mother of Shimshon, and Devorah, and Yael, and the good ones. And it's a polemic, but that's its own point. I don't think Professor Kadari is necessarily correct, though, in her read of the split between the Gemara and Esther Rabbah. Because the Midrash in Esther Rabbah has material on Vashti as also being an immoral person and a hater of Jews. Where I brought you two Midrashim in source number 9 and in number 10. In number 9, they make the point that the text in the Megillah says Vashti also made a feast. And they say she did everything her husband did, including wearing the clothing of the Kohen Gadol, which we talked about earlier. In number 10, it talks about her using the royal palace in order to give the women a lot of space to be able to use for immoral purposes. There are different views about how to read that midrash in number 10, but that's one read of it. And I would be more likely to say that it's not so much a split in which the Gemara and Megillah wants to present her in negative light and Midrash and Esther Rabbah doesn't have any need. I think there are, though, different traditions about her and indeed about the Megillah as a whole. It's very interesting. The Gemara, Babylonian, the Talmud Bavli, goes on at length with Midrashim about Megillat Esther. Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, almost nothing. Almost nothing. They had different traditions about, you know, in approaching it. So I think that's just, I think she's gone a little bit past her evidence, but I think there are, different traditions that are found in different places and that are recorded, therefore, by different texts. And if you read only one of them, you're going to miss what's going on in the other. Okay.
Can I say something?
Yes, please.
Could they both not be true? Could she not be immoral and want to do all these things, and yet at the same time, if this is a power struggle between her and Ahasuerus, she didn't want to give in to him and come in. She didn't want to demean herself and listen to him.
Yeah.
So you could have both of these views being true.
Agreed. Agreed. Okay. You don't have to end up with the answer of the tale. That's
right.
True. I find it entertaining, but yes.
Yeah.
But it's true. Three other notes to conclude this chapter. First of all, well, actually one of them I already did earlier. I talked about the fact that he consults his royal advisors and broadcasts it across the kingdom, that we did. But I mentioned to you in the first week that I want to also show you a little bit about language and different approaches to the book of Esther. So I brought you two things. One is language and the other is mysticism. Language. The Megillah has two different words that it uses for anger here, right? If you take a look at chapter 1, sentence 12, it uses them very oddly.
It's the...
Yeah, but before that,
well,
the verb. Vayiktsof. Right. Isn't that a strange phrase? This is going to be primarily for the Hebrew speakers. Vayiktsof hamelech me'od v'kitzpo ba'arabo is what it should have said. Right? You used one term. You know what it's like? It's like if you were to say in English, and he was very angry, and his rage burned in him. Why didn't you say, and he was very angry, his anger burned in him? Or he was outraged, and his rage burned in him. Why is it that the text says he had a lot of ketzef, one word for anger, and his chema burned in him, different word for anger? That doesn't follow. So the Malbim is always your go-to for things like this. The Malbim is a believer in the idea that every word is significant. There are no synonyms. It isn't simply this, it sounds better if I use two different words. It's a nicer sound. No, no, no. There's got to be a meaning. And here, I brought you, it's source number 11, what he does with it. He says, reading my translation, "And the king had great ketzef," which is one word for anger, "and his chema burned in him." There is a difference between ketzef and chema. For ketzef is open, and chema refers to keeping outrage in one's heart without revealing it from the lip and outward. Okay? He says, ketzef is visible anger. Everybody can tell. Chema is what burns inside. And he says, here there were two matters. Ahasuerus is angry about two different things. Open ketzef for refusing to obey his command, which was public. She defied him in public. That's Ketzef. Should have asked her himself instead of sending other people, then no one would have known. But he has open Ketzef. But also internal chema burning in his heart because she undermined his entire plot and all he had worked toward until now in the feast. He's been doing this for 6 months and 7 days, trying to build up to the point where he can take full control of the kingdom, as he says, in order to rule over an unlimited empire. And she just trashed it by refusing to show up at the party. His big moment is toast. And he can't say that. For these plans were hidden in his heart. So he didn't display the ketzef. It wasn't open. Only his chema burned in him. You follow? There are two aspects of anger at issue here. And you can read the Megillah a gazillion times and never notice it. Until Malbim says, hey, wait a minute. Ketzef, chema, why'd you switch words? Mind you, whenever you deal with someone like Malbim, who comes up with these overarching explanations of words and text, you always have to take it with a grain of salt. Because you're going to try to apply them everywhere and realize that there are some cases they don't really fit. So you just have to know that. An example, I gave a shiur a while back in which I noted that he has an explanation of the different... Oh, you know what? It was the Shmuel shiur on Thursday afternoons. We were talking about Shaul sparing Amalek. And how we use the term chemla, lachus, and lerachem. And Malbim says, here's what lachus means, here's what rachamim means, and here's what chemla means. And then you start to try to apply that where those words show up elsewhere, and you realize that works very well in the story of Shaul and Amalek. It doesn't work so well everywhere. Nonetheless, he's trying and is accomplishing more than I did. So, good. But that's just a language note on the chapter. Last note, and I realize I'm monologuing a lot. Usually I like questions also, but I really wanted to get through chapter one today. Chapter two is waiting. But mysticism, just because there has to be some mysticism for you. The Maharal has an endless commentary on Megillat Esther. An endless commentary on Megillat Esther. The Maharal is hard to read. He's verbose. And it's not, you don't always grasp what he's doing. But he loves to connect everything in Torah to broader themes. So whatever you see in a verse, he's going to give you a broader philosophical theme that it connects to. And he does not disappoint here in source number 12. He says, what do you mean on the seventh day? The party, yeah, this call for Vashti is on the seventh day. He says, maybe it's the seventh day. Maybe it's the third day. Why do I care what day of the party it was? As you can read in my translation. And this is difficult. Why did the text need to say on the seventh day? Let it be any day. Who cares what day it was? Apparently, this came to say that the entire matter of this scroll, meaning Megillat Esther, was not by chance. Everything happened as it should happen. It was according to a plan. What do you mean? The word for seventh in Hebrew is shivi'i. Seven is sheva. So he's good with the idea that shin and sin are the same letter, which isn't unique to him. That's a common idea. So he says, Shivi'i, the seventh, is a good day for the king's heart to be good. For that day itself is suited for Shivi'i with wine. What do you mean? For Shivi'i is of the same root as the term Sivi'a, V'achalta V'savata, to be sated, to be full. This number is of satiation without lacking. In other words, it's the day of being full. That's Yom HaShivi'i. And he says, I'll tell you why. We've explained in various places that the physical form has six sides, right? Top, bottom, four directions. And yet it is not sated, for there is still a seventh, the inner point. So this number seven is opposite the six sides and the middle between them. And there is no further deficiency. When you hit seven, you are complete, and that's why God completes the world on the seventh day. The world is now complete. And so he says that's why it's Yom HaShivi'i, is in order to say it's when everything is complete and all the plans are in place and the book is now going to follow from there. So Maharal has this whole long thing. I brought you like the tiniest section of his long commentary on just this point, just to show you, you know, somebody using something to make a bigger point, a bigger theme that you can connect to elsewhere. I brought you review questions at the end because we've said a lot of stuff, and I want to make sure that we understand at least some of what we've said. So, the three explanations we saw for Ahasuerus's party. So, we saw either it's about power and status. We anchored it in the text by showing how he has different divisions, different places for different people, different levels of decor for different people. The idea that he's celebrating the Jewish defeat in exile was anchored in the idea that it's the third year. Why is he waiting until the third year? When you do the math, you realize it can be a 70 from when we were exiled. And the idea that it's divine manipulation as seen in the words, Hu Achashverosh. This is the same Achashverosh who's going to become so different in the course of the story. Right now, he's killing his wife for the sake of his friend. Later, he's going to kill his friend for the sake of his wife and all of that. It shows you divine manipulation. How did the sages determine that Vashti was a Babylonian royal? So it looked at the conduct, his conduct, her conduct, but it's really drawing on the examples we have, the model of Izebel, Atalia, Michal, Bat Paro in Tanakh. And then it happens to really fit other aspects of the story. But it all starts by recognizing that him demanding that she show up and her refusal leads you there. She refuses to join the party either because she is immoral but embarrassed. Or alternatively, she is a victim, but really no one in the end absolves her of wickedness. No one in commenting on this story thinks that Vashti's a good person. That you don't get. Granted, Ruchama has redeemed her as a feminist, but no one thinks that she's of good character in this text. And then last, why does the text use two different words to describe the rage of Ahasuerus? And the idea is that there's the external, because she refused him, and then there's the internal, because she foiled his plans. Can have all new material for next week. Okay. Well, thank you very much. We have 1 minute left.
Can I ask one question?
Yes, please. Go ahead, Sue.
The second word for anger, does that word include a notion of shame?
That's interesting. You mean chema, to include a notion of shame in it?
Yeah.
What makes you ask that?
Well, because it's internal, and when you're ashamed, it's something very internal that causes anger.
That's an interesting question. We'd have to look and see where the word chema shows up. You know? I mean, I'm going to rule out chema in relation to God, because all of those anthropomorphisms are not analogous to others. So ba'afu v'chema v'ketzef gadol doesn't really translate. But other uses of chema that would fit that. That's an interesting question. I don't know.
Thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thank you. Something to think about for sure. Okay. Well, thank you very, very much. And I wish everybody a good week. And see you here next week, God willing. Be well.
Thank you. Larry Levy told me to say hello for him.
Oh, thank you so much. Please say hello back.
Okay.